We hope to live in harmony with the citizens of Europe.
We can expect Zagon to commence and sustain all our attacks.
Our knowledge and weapons.
Our ionization layer must be maintained until our relocation is effective.
Good.
Relocation? To where?
I don't remember anything else really being...
To your...
Cinematic dumpster fire right here on the Ghost Hollywood. And more information on the helicopter crash that occurred on the set of Twilight Zone.
Let's come for another segment of the cast.
We're going to be here tonight, guys.
Come on, come on. It's time for the Ghost of Hollywood.
Well, hello, wall crawlers, and welcome back to the Ghost of Hollywood. I'm Poxy Leonard here with Miss Reagan, and it's time for Halloween.
That said, what better way could we possibly begin the second season aside from our annual Halloween Eve countdown?
Ah, and to celebrate, Reagan and I have our friends Matt Leslie and Stephen Smith joining us on the show in a little bit to discuss their work writing and producing the 2018 horror cult hit Summer of 84.
Starring Rich Summer and Grant Brashear, the movie Summer of 84 takes us back to a time when suburbia wasn't exactly such an ordinary place.
Yeah, because that's changed.
Well, it definitely hasn't gotten any better. Anyway, directed by Francois Simard, Anouk, and Johan Wissel, who are collectively known as RKSS, Summer of 84 will be their second film, following 2015's Turbo Kid, starring Michael Ironside.
Digressing here for a second, but... you know that's the dude from Scanners.
He's been in a lot of movies.
Oh, that is true. That is true. Side note on Turbo Kid. Maybe I'm off here, but that movie is like pretty much Mega Man for adults.
I don't think Mega Man for adults works very well if you're looking for a descriptive accuracy, Poxy. But yeah. I can see what you're getting at.
Well, something was hidden that way for me, so I don't know. I went with my gut. That movie was fucking awesome. What? Alright, not my strong point, I suppose.
What is your strong point?
Let me get back to you on that. So, on to Summer of 84 again for a moment. First of all, let's put things into perspective for anyone who hasn't seen it. Now, I'll keep this simple. Fright Night meets The Burbs with the cast of Stand By Me.
That's pretty close.
Yeah, you get the idea. Now, where was I? Oh yeah, okay. So, that's happening a lot with age, by the way. Now, a group of young boys that run together in their neighborhood, which is set in the fictitious town of Cape May in Oregon, circa 1984, more on that later, they find themselves amongst the potential prey for a serial killer on the loose. And as the murderers find themselves closer and closer to home, you know, where they're hidden, the boys set out to catch the killer before he catches them.
More on that later, so stay tuned for our interview with the screenwriting team behind All That Madness here shortly.
You know, this episode also officially marks the one-year anniversary of The Ghost of Hollywood. To think in that span of time, we've gone from recording on a four-track in Zach's living room to an entire production team, like, in our own studio.
All I can think of is that awful stage mic that I was using and the wires we had Frankensteining everything together.
Yeah, and back then... that was, like, actually a step up for us compared to how primitive things were on War Pigs Arcade.
Yeah.
Yeah, still no interviews, no podcast, Pineapple Nightmare, nothing. But just look at us now. You know, now that I'm feeling nostalgic, let's revisit one of our own clips from the very first episode of Ghost of Hollywood, which took place over a year ago now during the Halloween season.
For the pilot, Poxy and I decided to talk about the 1951 film The Thing from Another World, featuring nothing other than 20 minutes of straight banter. This was just the beginning for Poxy and I, and I think it's safe to say we had no idea what we were doing or where we were going at the time.
All right, fair enough. Let's roll the clip. Loose on a little bit of cinema history, yeah.
Chill, Poxy, you can splurge about Howard Hawks all you want in a few minutes.
Yeah, all right. The thing from Another World is a fun one, though. I mean, old James Arnaz... coming to get you, baby.
Hold the phone. Here comes Poxy with some boomer jokes about Gunsmoke.
All I'm saying is, look out, Matt Dillon is coming for you, baby.
Are you done yet?
Yeah, sure. Maybe I'll just mix my next drink and let you take it over for a while.
Well, I've been trying to open the show for like 10 minutes now.
Well, you said it yourself. You drop a film like... a blast from the past, yeah, Ray?
It's like we haven't learned to read yet or something.
Yeah, it was kind of rough.
For sure. And what you just heard was a clip from the pilot episode of The Ghost of Hollywood, which originally aired for radio broadcast in October of 2020.
Yeah, you know, you like how we just play our own stuff. Having a little moment there. I'm sorry. But there is a reason why it's so short on the website, by the way.
What?
Well, the pilot. The original link actually ran for like 2 or so hours, but it was all basically music. So when Electric Garden reproduced the episode for podcasting, all of that shit was cut for, well, you know, it's cut away for legal reasons.
Which leaves us with 20 minutes of you and me essentially talking about trivial movie history.
Trivial?
Eat it, Poxy.
Reagan. All right, wall crawlers. It's good to be back here on The Ghost of Hollywood as we celebrate the Halloween season with our 13th episode, which is the first of the second season. That's confusing, isn't it? Now stay tuned, because tonight it's all about the 2018 soon-to-be cult classic, Summer of 84.
When Poxy and I return, screenwriters Matt Leslie and Stephen Smith will be joining us on the show to discuss their experience writing and working on that movie. Stay tuned, I'm Miss Reagan here with Poxy Leonard, and you're listening to The Ghost of Hollywood.
Want to be in the know for all things Ghost of Hollywood? Check out our website at theghostofhollywood.com for all the newest episodes and updates.
And don't forget to listen every other Friday live on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. If you're not local, you can also find us live on KBOO.FM. And while you're there, please consider donating to Portland's very own listener-powered radio.
Well, hello, wall crawlers. I'm Poxy Leonard here with Miss Reagan.
And you're listening to The Ghost of Hollywood. As a part of tonight's Halloween special, we are speaking with Matthew Leslie and Stephen J. Smith, the award-winning writers and producers of the 2018 horror movie Summer of 84.
Pleasure to have you on the show. How are you both doing this evening?
Good. Doing well. Good to be with you guys.
Yeah, likewise. Appreciate you coming on. Now, before we discuss Summer of 84, let's talk about how the two of you began working together. So, during an interview with Rise Up Daily in 2018, you mentioned meeting in Silver Lake at a writer's group. Steve, at some point you would return to Wisconsin for a period, and around this time you mentioned coming across the now-defunct Script-a-thon contest, which provoked you to call Matt about partnering up to enter. He agreed, y'all wrote the script, and won the contest. Had you two ever discussed collaborating before this? And Matt, were you surprised when he called?
Yeah, so that's true. We met at a writer's group in Silver Lake. It was held in a producer's living room. It was just a group of writers that would get together every week and bring like 10 pages. And we would read them out loud, act them out, and then give each other notes. And through that period, Matt and I just kind of got to know each other a little bit, liked each other's notes a lot. Never really talked about collaborating, just liked each other's style a lot. And then shortly after that, we both did a 2-year writing program called the Writers Boot Camp in Santa Monica, California. And we were both in the same class, just randomly, didn't know we were doing it together. So got in there, we were like, oh, good to see you. You know, we were both serious about it, liked each other's notes again. And then, yeah, I had to move back to Wisconsin during the Great Recession for work, and found this contest, the Script-a-thon online, which was basically write a script in 30 days or less and enter it in. And so I...
It's quick.
Yeah, it was really quick. But we did it. Called up Matt, suggested an idea that was fairly formulaic, and we banged it out in 28 days and then ended up winning the contest. And yeah, we just thought, you know, hey, there's something to this. You know, we beat out like 1,500 entries and we should probably just keep doing this. And so we've been writing together ever since then.
Well, I'm curious, whatever happened to that script, and could you tell us a little bit about its plot?
So, that script is sitting on a shelf. It was a male-centric romantic comedy about a guy who, he takes his girlfriend on a cruise, and he's afraid to propose to her, and she's pushing to propose, and he's commitment-phobic. And you find out he's commitment-phobic because he had an ex-girlfriend that broke his heart. And then once they get out on the cruise, it turns out that ex-girlfriend now wants him back and had arranged this whole thing to get them out on the cruise to try and win him back. So he's out on this cruise ship with the current girlfriend and the ex-girlfriend, and hijinks ensue. It was a pretty broad level comedy that we liked. It was a lot of fun to write, but probably is not right for the marketplace now. So we're just kind of sitting on it, and we'll see if it ever sees the light of day.
How long was it? How long was it, like, as far as the page length?
It's like 105 or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yep.
Oh,
it was called Abandoned Ship.
Yep.
So when Steven, you get the idea to call Matt about writing this, though. So Matt, where are you at this time? You're still out in LA. You're doing some stuff out there, right? How does this all tie in together?
Well, it was. I was pleasantly surprised to hear Steve call me about this because I was blown away by Steve's writing ability in the group. He was, you know, he'd been doing it a little bit longer than me at that point and was definitely, you know, much more advanced as a writer. But I think he, you know, we had a good vibe and a good. I think we had a similar sensibility. So when he called me, I was really excited because I was like, you know, struggling to write a script at the time on my own. And when he called about this, I was like, yeah, let's do this. And I know for me that my mind works better ping-ponging ideas off of somebody that's a sounding board. So Steve and I have a really good back and forth about like, oh, what about this? Oh, what about this? And it just helps with the idea generation. I know that guy, Robert McKee, who wrote the book Story, who's kind of like the godfather of screenwriting, he always says, you know, if you have 10 ideas, 9 of them are going to suck. It's about how quick can you get to that one good idea. And I feel like because I have a partner in Steve, we get to that 10th idea much more quickly than I would if I were alone. So it just helps the creativity, the creative process.
Well, how's the writing partnership work like say on the day to day, like when you all are working on a screenplay? Is one of you write predominantly? Is one of you more of a talker? Like how's the structure of it go when you actually laying it out?
Yeah, so we actually, it doesn't quite work that way. Because we started off writing long distance, I'm back in LA now, so that helps. Right. But because we were doing it long distance for so long, the way we would do it is we would just do these marathon phone calls and we would break an outline into 12 sequences. So every script we write has 12 sequences in it that are about 8 to 10 pages. When we get everything done, the outline's super tight and we know all the beats and everything. And then Matt will actually go off and write the odd sequences and I'll write the even sequences. Okay. And we'll do it separately like that. And then we'll trade and we'll revise each other's stuff. And then we'll bring it all together. And then we'll get back on the phone and run through it all together to get to the final draft. So,
yeah. And when we have that outline, it's like, you know, because there's two of us, it has to be really bulletproof because, you know, if I go off and write one sequence and he goes and writes another sequence, but we're not on the same page, it's going to be a disaster. So our outlines are like, you know, it's every single scene in the script. It's got even some hints of dialogue, anything that's really evocative to us that we really want in there. And then we go off and write our own sequences, but we're always on the same page with stuff. And then after we do that first pass, we can see if there are any glaring issues. And then it helps us to smooth it out from there. But it's been a really good process for us. And we kind of got that the 12 sequence thing from that writer's boot camp that Steve mentioned, that that's kind of how they pitched the idea of breaking a story down, that there's 12 sequences. Each one sort of has an ebb and flow, a beginning, middle, end. So that you have a nice, you know,
kind of like the seven point thing. I know there's different like
exactly.
formats. So
yeah,
like,
okay, yep.
I'm fine.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, at some point in 2014, you all began developing the idea for a story, which would ultimately culminate in the screenplay for Summer of 84. What was going on during the early stages of development, and when were you able to settle on an approach to the story?
We both grew up in the suburbs. Grew up in the suburbs of Massachusetts. Steve grew up in the suburbs of Wisconsin. And there's definitely like a certain, you know, way of life to living in the suburbs. And you know, it's quiet and sleepy. And I think people like us who have like really, you know, colorful imagination, you start to sort of, you know, your mind wanders. And we both had just kind of like these weird neighbors that we would just wonder like what they were like. What is that? Why do I only see that guy at midnight? Like, how come he's never mowing
Boo Radley's house? And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's like, yeah, it's like a low grade version of the Klopex house in the burbs, where it's like, they're not quite that like overtly sketchy, but sketchy enough that you're like, that guy's either a serial killer or he's in the CIA or some combination of the two. So anyway, all that to say, we love that subgenre of thriller mystery where it's like the paranoid neighborhood conspiracy thing, you know, the Rear Windows and, you know, stuff like that.
That it does have a Rear Window feel to it. Reagan and I were actually talking about the Rear Window feel because the ending plays into the Rear Window feel, not to cut you off.
Yeah.
No, following you.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And other movies like Fright Night, where it's like, what is my neighbor doing? And, you know, Stand By Me, The Lost Boys, you know, The Goonies, all those things where it's like something wild happening in my sleepy little community really inspired us. So I think I just hit Steve one day and I was like, I'd love to do, you know, Stranger Things wasn't a thing yet. And so I was just like, what if we just make a movie that takes place in the 80s about, you know, something scary happening. And ultimately what sparked us the most about it was not just, you know, writing a story like that, but subverting the expectations of how it would end. Because all those movies like Disturbia, Fright Night and Rear Window, it's always like a happy ending. And we always would joke about like, you know, if you really were right that your neighbor was a serial killer, you know, he'd probably best you. You know, you probably wouldn't come out, you know, all roses on that one. So we wanted to kind of represent that ending. So it's like a lot of the movie is like lulling you into a false sense of security where you're like, I've seen this movie, I get it, like I know what's going to happen, and then the ending happens and you're just like, oh shit, they, you know, that kid got killed and the other kid's going to be like living.
Yeah, yeah.
Spoiler alert. So anyway, that was kind of,
it kind of has like a put up or shut up feel to it, you know what I mean? But you put up at,
yeah, I mean, we, yeah, really wanted to, you go know, there. You know, it's just, we just, you know, as fans of that we were like, what do we want to see? That's what we want to see. And one of the biggest obstacles to getting it greenlit at the time was like, you know, the fact that we were going to be killing a teenager. But then, you know, It Comes at Night had a kid get murdered, and It had a kid murdered, like, or, you know, the kid's arm gets torn off. So like in the process of us trying to get the financing for the movie, like other movies came out that killed kids. And I think everybody got a little bit like, oh, all right, I guess you could do that. Cause you know, people were a little worried about that.
Yeah, I understand. I know that you mentioned you had all discussed that. You had also, you brought up Disturbia. So you had set up it again in another interview. You had mentioned about trying, part of Summer of 84 was doing it the right way, because you had said that they didn't really, you didn't feel that you had critiqued that movie or something along those lines, that you really didn't enjoy it and you wanted to do something, you wanted to do it the right way with Summer of 84.
I don't think I would say do it the right way. I think it's like, Disturbia is one of those movies where I love a lot about it, but there's certain choices that I think would have made it better. And it felt like,
maybe it was like the killer was too deliberate, I think is what you said. Sorry, I think like in the last interview, you were talking about the deliberacy of the killer not being kind of concealed. And
yeah, oh, for sure. Like, yeah, there was an element to that where in Disturbia, I mean, it's like every time you see the villain in that, I mean, it's like, it's just over the top. Like, he's just dripping with villainy, you know? It was kind of like, all right, like, that's a little ridiculous. He's walking around and nobody's catching on to this or anything. So when we were conceiving the Mackie character, we wanted to make sure that, like, yeah, he's a total villain, but at the same time, the neighborhood thinks he's an upstanding cop. And, you know, he comes across as kind of like a charming guy when he's in the presence of the other adults and stuff. And that was an important element to us on this,
yeah,
one.
Yeah, he's hiding his villainy. Exactly, yeah.
Now, I know the screenplay wasn't written until you got the green light. But once you began trying to pitch the idea, were you focused on production companies who were able to deliver a cinematic experience that matched the 80s films you were influenced by when putting the story together? Like, Matt, I know you had said that Turbo Kid's trailer you had seen, and that was kind of something that lured you to RKSS. But was there more to it than that?
Well, yeah, I mean, So we had an outline, and I was working as a development executive for a producer named Scott Bernstein. And I, you know, as part of your job as a development executive, you meet writers, you meet directors, because, you know, essentially, like, producers are all producers are developing a slate of projects to try to get movies made. So I took a meeting. I saw the trailer for Turbo Kid, and I was really impressed by the you know, it was like dripping with nostalgia, and like it was just like fun and schlocky and like, all but like in the best way. And so I was like, these guys feel like they might get the nostalgia that we're kind of trying to go for with Summer of 84. And so I set up a meeting with them, and in the meeting I always ask filmmakers, like, what are your five favorite movies? Because a lot of times you'll find that a filmmaker who made, you know, a drama really likes horror, because if you ask them their five favorite movies, and they started naming, you know, Fright Night, Rear Window, The Goonies, The Burbs. They started naming, those are like their favorite movies. And I was like, oh, I got to pitch this Summer of 84. So I pitched it to them in the room, and they loved it. And at the time, we didn't have the script written yet. It was just the outline. So once we had their kind of like stamp of approval on the outline, Steve and I set off to write it. When we wrote the draft, we got it to them and they loved it. And then they hopped on board. And then from there, it was just about finding the money. Because, you know, it's sort of like, part of, as a producer, what you try to do is build a package. So you have a screenplay, but then you have to find directors and get them attached, and then you have to find the money and get that attached, and then it's like your casting and whatever. So you're just always kind of building those packages to get movies made. Once we had them attached, the package was pretty, I think, pretty cool, and I think a lot of people were interested in it. Stranger Things then came out and threw a little bit of a curveball at us, because at the time we had some interest, and then Stranger Things came out and it soured some of the interest in the project, I think, because people were like, well, these guys are doing kind of what you were trying to do. But then when it came out and it became like a, you know, a pop culture phenomenon, I think it ended up ultimately working in our favor and led us to help us get the money to make our movie with Gunpowder and Sky, who was our studio on this one.
Now, I didn't want to bring up Stranger Things because I know, I know, having read and stuff, that the comparison is probably a bit excessive. But there are significant differences, and I'm not going to point them out. But what do you think they are? Because that's really where I'm curious, and, you know, I want to know that. What do you think are the most significant differences between some, obviously, other than the length of time and the duration that you would have for development of the plot? You know, as far as the two have been compared, you know, on a day-to-day basis, and what you've heard already, what do you think?
I think one of the biggest differences is just tone. I think, like, we set out to do a very grounded, kind of darker tone. It's more about, like, these kids who are, you know, at the end of their age of innocence, kind of. This thing is going to come into their neighborhood and sweep through their lives, and childhood is over for them after this. And I think with Stranger Things, it's a little bit more... it's living in sort of like that more lighthearted kid space for the duration of the series so far, really. I mean, they kind of stay there. I mean, like, yes, scary stuff is happening to them, but it's still kind of like, it's fun. And you have those moments of like teenage zaniness and what, you know, and we definitely didn't want that. We wanted more of a, you know, a straight fastball down the line, you know, like this is dark. Like, as soon as they start on this path, there's no going back and they're never going to be kids again.
Yeah, I think if you just sort of take away, you know, group of teenagers riding bikes in the summer in the 80s, which I understand is sort of like it's the exact same context. Beyond that, there's nothing, I think, similar. Like, we're going for super grounded, real life, like, you know, this could really happen to you. Whereas Stranger Things, I think, is, you know, definitely Amblin-esque, Steven Spielbergian, sci-fi, you know, awesomeness. But just, you know, but obviously we understand why people compare it. It has been a bit of a frustration because we would love for this to just get sort of like, you know, judged on its own merits. But, you know, we came out at a time when this thing was sweeping through the whole world. So it just is what it is, you know.
Well, it kind of picked up. I mean, you know, its momentum was natural, so I don't think anybody can anticipate that. But the one thing that, you know, I will say that I noticed was different is it wasn't the for a four kids setting even. And maybe the age brackets being the same, I felt like your characters were more mature in the sense that you kind of, like, where the Stand By Me reference comes in earlier. You've got more of, you know, the dialogue and the conversation's a little more gritty and a little more closed doors as to where it's not as palatable as you might give it with, like, cookie cutter. It's more organic and real, like it, how it would have gone in reality, you know? Like, I mean, we've all been teenage boys. Not all. Sorry, Rick. But the three of us have been teenage boys in the treehouse, and you know that sometimes the conversation isn't so conventional. So I felt like that organic component gave it a level of maturity that was a little more feel real sense, for lack of a better description. But I'll shut up. What you wanted to ask them, Ray? What do you want to ask?
Oh, well, how long were you guys trying to get this project off the ground before RKS has picked it up?
Well, honestly, we were just early days when RKSS came on board. Like, we hadn't even written the script yet. So I think Steve and I had maybe spent like a month on the outline, maybe at that point. Mm-hmm. And then that's when we had RKSS read the outline. And then we started off on the script. But I think soup to nuts, though, for the entire thing, probably 2-year process or so, right, Steve? Before, like, from yeah. writing the outline to getting the movie on greenlit.
Yep, 2 years.
That's not too bad. That's pretty quick, having done it all on your own. You know?
For sure, yeah. Yeah. We were definitely, that's a, if every movie happened within that time frame, I think that, you know, everybody would be a lot happier.
Yeah, it's a lottery card in some ways. You're right, that's true. I guess, yeah. But it makes you hungry to do more, which is, I'm sure, where you're at now. You've talked about RKSS really was pretty much good with the script before. So I don't really want to ask the question the way that I had initially worded, but how about with each other? Where did you deviate from each other in the screenplay? You know, when you were developing it, what were some of the
Steve
ideas?
And I?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Steve and I'd actually really love to hear what Steve would have to say about this. But I think for me, what I love about our dynamic is that there's no ego. So if I ever pitch something and Steve's just like, I don't think that works, it's like, all right, cool, moving on. Like,
well, that's more what I mean. I mean, I don't mean like the like a personality challenge or like complications in the writing relationship. Just like, what were some of the ideas that kind of got tossed aside, or maybe that some of you brought to the that you brought to the table, and as they worked themselves out as time went, you know what I mean?
The only idea that I don't think Steve shot this down. I think it was more just like as it got closer to production. We had it that all of the kids died on that island except for Davey. Like, we had it, they all got on the island, and they're sort of picked off one by one by Mackie. And
so does it turn into like the most dangerous game sort of scenario at the end with him going after him? Was it played out? Like, was the original screenplay longer, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Well, I think this is before we actually went to script pages. This is when we were still,
so you're still in treatment.
Okay, yeah. So, it was very much like that. Like he's, you know, one of the things that we loved is that these kids played Manhunt, which was a game that I played when I was growing up in the summertime at night, which is like flashlight tag, basically, you know?
Yeah.
But what we loved is that it all gets flipped at the end. And that's when, you know, Mackie's on the island with him and he says, you know, we're going to play Manhunt, only now we're going to play it for real. And so it was sort of that. It's like he's hunting them. And he gets them one by one, except for Davey, and then he makes Davey, you know, basically go off and live his life looking over his shoulder. So, but it was just too dark. People were like, "Dude, that's just too dark. You can't kill three teenage boys on an island."
Yeah, I think our manager was like, "What are you doing to me?" No. You know, it's like, "No, you can't do that."
Yeah. Was there anything else, Steve, that you can remember?
That's the only big thing that I remember. Yeah. I mean, yeah, until we got to production, nothing else really changed, I don't think.
Yeah.
What changed in production?
Well, we had a couple scenes that didn't make it into the movie for various reasons, but also like locations. Like in the original script, the bowling alley scene, for example, takes place in a roller rink. And then when we got up to Vancouver to film it turns out Vancouver, they're not so into roller rinks. You can't find one. They don't. So we just had to, we're like, okay, what else could this be? And then we figured out bowling alley. And then it was really funny too, because it's supposed to be the U.S., and, you know, we have like the big bowling balls and the big pins, and up there all they have is the candlestick stuff. And you're like, oh my God, you know, so we had to like ship in pins, and it was like so complicated, you know. But yeah, we had like a cold open on the movie that Matt likes to talk about, so I'll let him talk about that. We had a different intro for Nikki, just things like that. So yeah, but cold open, Matt, go.
The cold open was a lot of fun, and we actually did shoot it, but it didn't quite cut together, so it ended up on the cutting room floor. But basically the idea in the cold open was you open up with this kid just running like hell through the woods, freaking out, clearly being chased.
All right.
And it, you know, there's a thick canopy of trees, and it's like, you know, surrounded by, you know, greenery, and he bursts through this, you know, this like bush and falls into the water. And like, you know, scrambles and like real, like basically he's like doggy paddling, looking around like, where am I? He's in the middle of nowhere, makes his way back to the shore. And he's like looking around like, where am I? And then he gets clubbed in the head. And we sort of like, we end on his face. And then we match cut to his face on the front page of a newspaper. And it's Davey delivering the newspaper in the beginning. And essentially it's just like, it's number one, establishing, like opening on a cold open where something exciting is happening, but also establishing this, the Tidal Island, which is where we end the movie. Because, you know, Tidal Islands, what's really cool in Massachusetts, where I'm from, there are islands where you can drive onto it during low tide because there's a road. And then at high tide, the road's gone. So it's like, now it's an island. You know, so low tide, you can drive on, high tide, you can't. And we just thought that'd be such a really cool setting to have a finale where this guy, this is where he buries the bodies and hunts these kids and at high tide. And so that sort of established the island, but it ended up getting cut. So, you know, now it's sort of like, you know, it's just kind of the ending. You get a little bit of that. But we built a little bit more into the script. It just didn't quite work out to get into the actual film.
I see what you mean. That's still pretty wild, though. If it had like if you were able to make a serial out of it or something like that, you know, where you had the time and the space to do it, it would probably be pretty cool.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
Well, given RKS's retro aesthetic work on Turbo Kid, how do you feel that they are able to contribute to the nostalgic vision that you guys had for Summer of 84?
I mean, right off the bat, like they're just such fans of, you know, like Matt was saying, like the 80s movies that we were kind of referencing in our script, and they just, you know, they have the nostalgia thing down pat. Like if you meet them, you're like, yeah, these are 80s kids, you know, you can tell. So their whole vision right from the beginning was, you know, right in line with that.
Yeah, very much so. And then also their DP, like how they wanted to shoot the movie. Like they wanted to make sure that we shot with lenses and, you know, with a sort of like a color palette that feels like it's like if you just popped in a VHS tape from the 80s, you know, like they wanted it to really feel that way. So it's like, yeah, you're watching a movie in, you know, 2018, but it feels like you just found a movie that you didn't know existed in the 80s.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, you know, because in reading in specs, was it shot on a red cinema camera? Am I correct in that?
Yeah, it was a red Epic Dragon. Yeah.
All right, cool. So I'm with you then. Now, farthering that then, when was the decision made to shoot in anamorphic form, and was there a particular reason for this approach? I mean, I know a lot of those films at that era didn't shoot in anamorphic, but it was really popular around, like, it kind of had its resurge with the, you know, the Airy around the time that you all were in production on this. So was that part of it, or what was the reason?
Well, so our DP on the film, his name is JP Bernier. He's the guy who shoots all of RKSS's shorts and films and stuff. And JP, along with RKSS, decided they really wanted to shoot with Cook anamorphic lenses. And at the time, I know, you know, he said that it's really just about how it creates like a character portrait. Like when you're in mm-hmm. moments with characters, the way that it makes an actor's face look is just, there's just like a cinematic texture to it that he doesn't feel like is the case with spherical lenses. So he just loves the texture of anamorphics. I know that he, you know, he shot other films with spherical lenses. But I know that for this one, he just felt like it was the right texture. And I know RKSS agreed with that. So, and honestly, like one of the things that I will say in a couple of years since the movie came out, people are always shocked when I tell them that the budget was like $1.5 million. Everybody thinks it's like a $5 million movie because of how nice it looks
like it.
Yeah, it looks great. And it really is. It's because of the work that they did. I mean, I think it's just, you would never know that it was such a low budget movie.
Well, it's like, I mean, it's, you know, back on Turbo Kid to deviate for a second, because I went and watched Turbo Kid after, and I had seen this afterward. I came across this randomly, so I had targeted Turbo Kid to kind of get an idea of it. In the aesthetic there, you know, we could talk about all of the nostalgic and the stuff that's in there as far as the viewfinders and all of that, but, or even in Summer of 84, the way that's set in. But the aesthetic, or the way, like, you talk about the color palette and the way that it looks itself, that's what really got me about this, because it does have that resemblance. It picks up the same sort of aesthetic appeal that like Fright Night, I would say, really heavily had, and The Burbs, largely because of the, you know, the scenes being shot in neighborhoods and with kids. But on that, did the cameras color, how the camera's color science factored into this, or can you say like where the color palette comes into play?
No, I mean, I think in post when they were coloring it, there's definitely like a richness to the color scheme. You know, it's definitely dark and rich. And I think that what they liked about the Red Epic Dragon at the time, the sensor, I think what it did a really good job at is low light stuff. And we had a lot of low light. We had a lot of night scenes and basement scenes. And we wanted to be able to pick up on some of that, you know, some of the detail in the darkness. And then also it's like, you know, you want to have, when you're shooting something, you want it to be light enough that when you get into post production, you can adjust the light how you want
it
to.
You can correct and grade it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I know that was a big part of it too. So that when we got into post, we could make sure that we could adjust the dark, the light and dark levels accordingly, still getting the texture we wanted to. I think that was a lot of what it had to do with.
Well, Summer of 84 is set in the state of Oregon, but was largely filmed in Vancouver, BC. What factored into location choice and inspired the fictitious town of Cape May?
Steve, you got that one?
Oh, well, is this going to get weird?
No, it's not going to get weird. It's just a funny, you know.
Yeah, so originally the script took place in Ipswich, Massachusetts, which is close to where Matt grew up. And so, like, he knew the area and, you know, it was easy to imagine it and create the script. When we got the production companies on board, and Brightlight Pictures is up in Vancouver, and there was a decision to shoot it there with all of their resources and everything. And, you know, the northeast of the U.S. just has that look to it, you know, and nothing up in Vancouver really had that same look, but it does have a look like the Pacific Northwest. So we just kind of lifted the name Ipswich and just plopped it down in Oregon instead. And so it's the fictitious town there. And then Cape May, what was the, I know we had like a lot of names for Cape May.
Yeah,
I
mean, it was,
what was that one?
It was just about clearances, right? Because we wanted to name him the, you know, the Cape May Killer or something like that. And it was like, any kind of names in movies, you have to get cleared for legal reasons. And apparently, like, there was...
Elaborate on this.
Well, originally it was Cape something else.
Cape Ann at some point. And
the Cape, there were a few of them. It might have been the Cape, because in Massachusetts, in Ipswich, where I'm from, it's called Cape Ann. That's the area. Okay. So I think we were like, oh, it's the Cape Ann Killer. And then we were going to just like plop that down in the Pacific Northwest. And there, apparently when we tried to get the name the Cape Ann Killer cleared, there was a book from some time that had a guy in it called the Cape Ann Killer. And so they were like, you can't do that. So then it was like, well, because the Cape Ann Butcher, the Cape Ann. So we just decided to change the name to Cape May. So we ended up calling the Cape May Killer. Anyway, it's just like, you know, any name, like even just the name of characters like Wayne Mackey, like they have to get that name cleared, because if there is a Wayne Mackey who lives in Portland, who is a cop, it's disparaging. It's like, you know, it's like slander. Like we're saying he's a serial killer or something. So there's all kinds of legal reasons for stuff like that. But I think that's what it was. But yeah, so anyway, to Steve's point, it was supposed to be Massachusetts. And then when we got, you know, because the directors are Canadian, the production company is Canadian, so there's all kinds of tax credits. So we were just like, you know, we'll shoot it up there and just change it to Pacific Northwest in Massachusetts, or in Oregon. So, yeah.
All right, well, Matt, in the movie, your wife, Susie Castillo, plays Woody Woodworth's alcoholic mother, Brenda. Although both of you have a history working in entertainment, what brought you together on this project?
Well, it's funny, like, you know, this is one of those things where, like, she's such a talented actor, and it's so hard oftentimes to get work, you know, and at the time she wasn't working on anything. And I just said to RKSS, I was like, hey, listen, my wife is, you know, super talented. Would you guys be down to like have her audition for some of these roles? And originally we were going to have her, we had her audition for the role of Davy's mom, because we hadn't cast Davy yet. But as soon as we cast Davy, we knew we couldn't have Susie play that role, because, you know, they just don't look, Davy just does not look like he could be the son of my wife. Graham Verschier just does not look like he could be her son. So anyway, we ended up kind of pivoting because Caleb Emery, you know, he's got the same curly hair as my wife. And so anyway, RKSS really liked the job Susie did on her audition. And they were like, why don't we have her play Woody's mom? And honestly, it was one of the most, like, you know, poignant moments on set, because, you know, it's like this, it's this moment where Woody comes home, and you, one of the things that we really wanted to do is give everybody a glimpse into, you know, because Steve wrote this line in the movie about, you know, Steve, what's the line about, that's why they invented curtains, hon, you know, because it's like, you know, you don't really know what's going on in other people's homes.
When they're having like when they're eating in front of the TV, right?
Yeah,
and they're talking
yep.
about the kids getting divorced.
Yep.
The TV dinner thing, that hit me. Like, I actually went and talked about this kid I grew up with whose family did that, and like how it was, because my kids are like, what do you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
No, this was the thing. You like Matilda'd it up. You sat down in front of the TV with the tray.
Yeah, the microwave dinner, yeah.
yeah.
But anyway, we really wanted to just show quick little glimpses into their lives, because it's not a TV series, but we wanted, you know, the theme is like what's really going on behind closed doors. So we wanted to show that in little glimpses. And for Woody, it's like, you know, you think he's this happy-go-lucky kid and he's the goofball of the group. And then you get, you know, you get to meet his mom and you realize that she's a workaholic because she has to, because, you know, it's just a single mom. And she's got a drinking problem because, you know, she's just, life is just too much. So that day, you know, Susie was just like, I mean, obviously it required tears, and like, it was just like one of those, it was probably the most serious moment on set the whole time, where like the crew was kind of in tears. She was crying. The director was crying. We were all, it was just like really emotional because she really took it there. And so I was really proud of the job that she did on that. It was really cool to see.
Now, you say Woody comes from like a childhood friend of one of yours. The character is kind of established from that too. Was their life in equal dire straits, kind of like that?
No, not at all. So my friend, his name is Aaron Woodworth. I've known him since kindergarten.
That now he's, we know where the Woodworth name came from. Right?
Yeah. we call him Woody. He's the sweetest dude. He's the sweetest dude ever. He has an awesome family. None of that. Like, he's just like very, you know, all American. He's a police officer, actually, ironically, because we didn't had nothing. Wayne Mackey had nothing to do with Woody, the real life Woody. But it was just my buddy Woody is just like the sweetest guy ever. Like, he's just one of those people that everybody loves him. He hasn't got a bad bone in his body. And that's kind of what we wanted to create in this character, because who would it suck to see get murdered? The kid that you just love, you know, like, like, that's really what we were trying to do.
Yeah.
There. We were trying to like get
right at the
end.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's kind of how we modeled him after my buddy Woody.
The Polybius cabinet that was out of order in the arcade. Could you explain its significance?
So that actually comes because we knew that we were going to have this bowling alley with arcade machines. And at the time, that we were filming the movie, Matt and I were developing out a TV series idea that centered on the Polybius urban legend, which happened in Portland, Oregon. And so we just thought, since we're having a movie take place in Oregon and we know that we're developing this thing that ultimately will probably, you know, hopefully one day become a thing for us, we're like, wouldn't it be funny to like stick this thing in the background as a cool Easter egg? And it's out of order because, you know, it was an urban legend. Nobody knows what it looked like. And also, you know, we didn't have our project up off the ground yet, so it was out of order. It was just kind of being formed. And so it was like the perfect little thing. And hopefully one day people will look at that and be like, oh, like they knew that they were going to do this TV series later. And,
For anybody who's out there listening that doesn't know the Polybius urban legend, it's basically in 1981 in Portland, Oregon, the urban legend goes that there was this arcade cabinet that got dropped off at local arcades by these men in black suits, CIA types, dropped the arcade cabinet off. And kids started playing it and they became obsessed with it. Like fights started breaking out, lines were down the block. And the kids who played it the most started suffering from like these, you know, psychological like depression and suicidal thoughts and, you know, just like hallucinations.
It's like the infinite jest of
arcade. And so basically 30 days after, you know, like these guys would come and service the machines, but they wouldn't take any of the change that was accumulating. They were just like tweaking. And then after 30 days, the thing just like vanished. Like they came and took them away and it was never heard from again. And the urban legend goes that it was part of a CIA program called MKUltra that's a real declassified program where they were trying to purportedly figure out mind control, and that this game through sonically and visually was tapping into the minds of kids to see if they can control the kids. So that was that's the jumping off point for our series, and sort of like where it goes from there is the fun part. But for us, it was like, let's just put this arcade cabinet in here. It'll be fun. And our production designer, Justin, just did such a good job, and he just made it. It's exactly how we envisioned it to be.
What our the co-writer of the show is. His name is Chris. He picked it off immediately and brought it up several times in the writing sessions. And he had it written like somebody or Reagan knew. And Reagan's, I don't know this machine, but we'll ask about it. And we're like, all right, but just put it in the interview, because he was really concerned. But but it's funny, if you haven't been to Ground Control before? Or like, have you been out here? Out to Portland, you've got to check out Ground Control downtown, because the aesthetic for that is going to, like, you know, kind of just literally smack you in the face for what you're looking for. Even if you don't utilize the area, that is, I'm telling you, that's the spot to check out and model off of. It looks ID for it.
All right.
Anyway,
amazing.
So
nice.
Back on task. Sorry. In a previous interview, you both discussed the difficulties behind casting for Mackie. Who were some of the actors you had in mind initially before casting Rich Sommer? Because you kind of went out there. I don't know this process very well. Explain the process of how you had to kind of pitch to these actors and whether or not they were interested or not. Well, make a callback on it.
Well, the way that it always works in terms of, you know, when you get a movie greenlit, you have a financier who's the one paying for it. And they always want to get the biggest possible name for every role. And so you sort of have to go through this process where you make offers to people who aren't maybe attainable, like big name people, and then they pass on it, and then you continue on. For this movie, I don't even remember who we went to, Steve. Do you remember who were the first people we went to? I know we went to Nathan Fillion.
We went to him. We went to Greg Kinnear at one point. We went to Ethan Hawke at one point. Those are the ones I remember early on. Yeah.
But, you know, every one of those guys, we were offering Schedule F, which is a term used to denote the offer, which is not a lot of money. It's just not enough money to get Nathan Fillion or Ethan Hawke. They're just, you know, unless they were like had written it or were directing it, they're just not going to do it. So it's anyway, all that to say, that's how the casting process goes. You make offers that are probably out of your league. And then you come down to earth and you get actors. And so what was really cool about Rich Sommer was that he was always somebody that we were like, he would be so good for this role. But it was just like, I don't know if it'll ever happen, if we'll be able to get to him. And then when we did get it to him and he loved it, we were just like, oh my God, this is amazing. Because ultimately for us, it was like, we just wanted to get somebody who was an amazing actor. We didn't really care about, like, you know, getting... Because, you know, like, not to take anything away from Rich, but it's like, you know, A-list in terms of, like, Brad Pitt or somebody. Like, we're not going to get Brad Pitt like or somebody like that, but we wanted to get somebody who's just like an insanely talented actor who's maybe not on everyone's radar. And that's exactly what Rich is. Rich is just one of these guys that's had this insane career, killing it in every role that he's in. And he brought so much life to this character. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, and the other thing that was great about Rich too is like he's at the level of celebrity where like you recognize him, you know him. He's a great actor. But throughout the movie, it still allows you to kind of be like, is it him? Will it be him? You know, where if it's like a Brad Pitt, you're just like, well, of course it's, you know, like he wouldn't take the role. Whereas with Rich, it was like Rich allows you to keep guessing, you know? So
yeah, he disappears into the character. Exactly.
There's that scene at the door when Davey's grounded and he comes to talk to Davey and they transpire back and forth there. And I feel like what's funny there is Davey almost comes off unlikable and you like Rich's character. You like Mackie a little better. You know, like he's very, very likable. And I know that they like, you know, his work in Mad Men, I'm not too familiar with that. And I know that you had all mentioned that when he had come across your radar the first time that the dynamic of his acting abilities had been mentioned. So that said, were you guys writing a character with a particular serial killer in mind that kind of had that docile sort of, I don't know, I mean, I guess John Gacy or Ted Bundy to be cliche, but was there something that factored in a little deeper in that or outside of that?
Yeah, I mean, the ones you mentioned for sure. And then, you know, I grew up in the Milwaukee area during the Dahmer days, you know, so, you know,
Milwaukee monster.
Yeah. So like, you know, it was kind of this idea of like, you know, you just don't know, you know, like these seemingly normal people, what are they doing behind closed doors, you know, which is a big thing in the movie. And so, yeah, we were definitely trying to play off that aspect of the serial killer. But I don't know that we were targeting any specific one in mind. It was just kind of a collection of them. Right, Matt?
Yeah, for sure. I think John Wayne Gacy is like the obvious one just because he was like the suburban stalker who was just like seemingly, you know, normal guy neighbor. And he was killing teenage boys and burying them under his house, you know. And then Easter egg is that Rich Summer drives a Volkswagen Beetle, which is this, you know, the same thing that that Ted Bundy drove. So, you know, it's just like little stuff like that we had fun with. And, you know, obviously having fun with something really dark, it was an interesting process. But ultimately, the serial killer world is just endlessly fascinating.
they get pretty strange, that's for sure.
Well, I would imagine that when you write a character, you have an idea of how they will look and sound. With that said, how involved in the casting process were you guys?
We were really heavily involved. Matt being like a full capital B producer on the picture, like really like unlocked everything like that for us. You know, like I was not a producer on it, but I got to take the whole ride because of Matt and I, you know, partnership. So yeah, through the whole time, I mean, we were, you know, every kid that was sending in tapes, we got to review, you know, I don't know, dozens, if not maybe 100 kids, you know, for all the roles. And, you know, when it came time to do Mackie, they asked us who we thought, and, you know, so we were really heavily involved throughout.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I'm really glad we got to be, and RKSS were very collaborative in that regard, like, because, you know, they knew that this was our, like, this is our baby. Like, we, you know, this was like our brainchild, and they really cared what we thought and were open to our thoughts.
I want to ask about the dialogue. What was it like to revisit being a teenage boy in that era when writing those scenes?
I mean, this, I don't know, it's ridiculous to say, but I feel like it's kind of true. I feel like I'm still a teenage boy inside of my mind. I don't really feel like I've matured that much. Like, you know, it's like that voice is still inside of me. So I think it was just fun to just like let it loose and just like be ridiculous and, you know, have a little fun with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like as adult, I mean, you still have that voice in your head. So it's like, you know, like you're just kind of sitting there watching TV with your wife or whatever. And like, you know, something funny pops in your head. You're like, no, I can't say it to her. She want to breathe.
Yeah.
You know, but like but between us, you know, like, we just got to do it all on the page. It's great.
Yeah. Teenage boys just say like they honestly just say whatever, because I think they're just figuring out how to be people. You know, like you're just like you're suddenly at an age where you're having all these weird thoughts and feelings because your hormones are going crazy. Your brain is developing. It's just all very weird. You know, it's just like this strange time. And so it was really fun to kind of just like write ridiculousness and have fun with it.
We had to, you know, kind of curb a little bit of what they would actually say in the era. You know, like we wanted to be era appropriate. But also there are definitely like you know, no one was PC back then, and you kind of had to, you know, nobody watched what they said. Or so, yeah. You know, there was definitely a little bit of like combing through dialogue where it was like, whatever your first line was, like, that's a little questionable. Like, let's scale that back a little bit.
How did you make it balance with the overall tone of the film? Because the humor is really genuine. And like the scene in the car, when they're all in the car and they get busted, you know, like there are some moments where the movie's pretty like kind of light. And it, I feel like the really dark, the darkest component of it is definitely the end, you know, where its continuity drives down and pulls you, you know, in toward that sort of fear basis at the end with the unknown. But how did you balance, or how did you focus, or especially probably more in production than in writing, with the continuity of tone?
Well, I think it was both, but really it's like when you break it down to its simplest place, this is an adventure for these kids. Like, I don't think any of them really, really thinks that Mackie was the killer. Like, I think Davey is like, I think Davey does deep down, like in his gut, he's like, this is just something that's not right. But I think that if it turned out the other way, he would have been like, man, I don't know. I guess I misjudged him. But I, you know, but the other three kids are just like, I'm bored. It's summer. Like, this is fun. You know, let's spy on this weird guy, you know, like, so I think it's like they're not really taking it all that seriously. So to them, it's just like, let's just have fun and be goofy. And we wanted that to come alive in these scenes because, you know, we wanted it to feel authentic. And, you know, the thing is about like, I would always say like, because there's like a tonal shift, right? Suddenly it's like, oh, yeah. Shit, like we could die here. But it's like if you're walking down the street and you're having a conversation with your buddy and you're laughing and then suddenly a van pulls over and someone jumps out and kidnaps you, everything gets very scary and serious very suddenly. And that's kind of how this would work, right? Like it's all fun and games until it's not anymore. Like suddenly it's very serious. And that's kind of that was the line we were walking on this one. It was like, how do we do that? But I think that was one of the most fun aspects of developing it, is like, how do you pull that off?
Well, you hammered that, especially because you've got you've got that kind of flow where you don't believe it until they know it. You know, it's almost like you're kind of almost wondering, you're like, is this, you know, everything's okay. Like you say, the way you described it, I don't need to be redundant. Now, a lot of critics did praise the ending of the film. You know, that was the big hook for it. So a lot of critics praise the ending of the film. And I know that you talked about a lot of all the kids being killed in the original version of the screenplay or the treatment. Do you think solely killing off Woody served to help the story in the long run? What was the feedback you got on that, positive and negative?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody... Once we made that decision, like I said, like we mentioned our manager before and like people that we had reading it, it's just really like when you focus it on the one kid and it's the kid that you just love to death throughout the whole movie, and it's Davey's, you know, arguably best friend through the whole movie, it really just kind of focuses all that emotion on that one thing. Whereas, you know, if it was more than one kid dying at the end, you'd kind of spread across those kids with that emotion and it wouldn't hit as hard as it did. So I think it definitely helps the ending that we just narrowed it down to the one kid.
Yeah. It also forces Davey to confront that he's dead because of him. Like really at the end of the day, it's like if Davey had just stopped this obsession and not continued this, you know, this adventure that he was on, Woody would be alive. You know what I mean? And like that's at the end of the movie, he's left with that reality. And of course, like, and as you see, like at the very end of the movie, when Davey's riding his bike and delivering the paper, you can see Eats and Faraday coming out of Eats's house, tearing down the treehouse, right? Because it's like, but it's, and they're not even like really friends with Davey anymore because of what's gone on. It's sort of just like, you know, everything is broken by the end of the film because of the obsession. And that was kind of like a big part of the arc for Davey, which is like, you know, an obsession like that maybe doesn't lead to a positive outcome.
I've got to ask, because you brought up Faraday, does the name from Faraday come from the physicist Michael Faraday? Was there a correlation in that, or was it just totally random? Because he's kind of like the nerdy kid, but then there's like Faraday's law and stuff, so I was like, I'm wondering if there's a play on this.
No, so that's another. So I grew up with a kid named Chris Faraday.
All right.
And Chris was this super smart kid. And I lost track of Chris in life, but I think he's like lives in San Francisco and is like, you know, like literally a rocket scientist.
Oh, okay.
So like just one of the brightest people. And that's kind of where the name came from for Faraday.
All right. Well, let's turn to the score, because the score, again, RKSS hit this with Turbo Kid, but it really nails it here. LaMottos, where do they come in? Because they're heavily influenced by, like, 80s groups, especially, like, in particular, Tangerine Dream. What's the story behind their involvement in the film? Or in the soundtrack to making the film, sorry.
So the cinematographer is one half of the band, LaMottos.
I had no
so
idea.
So it was kind of baked. Yeah, it was kind of baked into the equation where it was like, you know, JP, the cinematographer. What's great about it, too, is that, like, as a composer, the more ingratiated in the project, like, the more ingrained in the project that you are, I think the better you can evoke through score. So having him there every day on set shooting with us, seeing every moment and really understanding the movie from a fun, like a really fundamental level, I think really helped with when we were in post-production and him and his partner had to, you know, come up with the score, because I think they only had a few weeks to make the score. Like they did it quick. Steve, do you remember how long they had?
It was only, it was only like a month, maybe and a half quick. Max, something like that. I mean, it was interesting too, like hanging out with JP on set, because like every now and then he kind of mentioned like some reference bands that he was thinking of incorporating, and like every time he would do it, like Matt and I would just be like, huh, you know, like that's interesting, like they mentioned like it was a lot of kind of like more metal sounding bands, or like, and then like at one point they mentioned like Gremlin and things like, you know, we were like, yeah. So then we'd listen to it and we'd be like, okay, that'll be interesting, I guess, and then like they turned in their first draft of the score and it was just, I mean, it was amazing, like we all just listened to it, it was like, holy, they know this movie, they know this town, you know, it was great.
Yeah, because it's essential, like, to, you know, that I feel like that when I revisited it, I was really looking for where that kind of 80s retro vibe hit, and I feel like that was a huge component of it, for sure, to really lock it down, you know what I mean?
It's sort of the backbone, the driving force of it, and I mean, it is one of the strongest parts of the film, for sure. It's such a great score.
And kind of in a meta full circle, too, like, you know, like when we're writing new scripts now, like I just listen to that score all the time, so that's kind of amazing, you know, like writing a new story with the music from the old story, you know.
Oh, no, but do you do that thing as a screenwriter or like as a writer in general sometimes, where you like find a song that's just kind of got a mode to it, and you're like, all right, I'm going to go off and think over and over while I'm listening to this song and kind of getting the tone of it. Does that happen? Am I crazy?
Yep.
Okay, cool. I'm just wanted to check.
We just have to make sure he's not crazy. We've been questioning for a while.
No. Exactly. I do that all the time, where I'll find a song that is kind of benign in a way. Like it's not intrusive, and I'll just have it on a loop, because it just allows me to not be, it just like to go off into my mind, and I'll just play it like over and over and over again.
Yeah, like instrumental soundtrack music. Exactly.
Yeah. No lyrics, yeah.
Summer Ready 4 debuted at the Sundance Film Festival in 2018. What was this experience like for the both of you?
Oh man, Steve, you got to tell the story, bro. Steve.
All right,
Steve.
So I had a very unique experience with the film fest. So when the film festival was happening, my wife was heavily pregnant and due to have our second child like 3 weeks after the film festival was done. So I figured it would be all right, you know, got some time. So we went to the festival, and we got there on like a Thursday, I think. And the first few days, like, it was just a whirlwind of meetings. We didn't see a single movie. And, you know, I was just kind of seeing the celebrities around. It was really cool. And we were building up to the premiere of our movie, which was going to be on Tuesday night, Matt, or Monday night?
I think Monday night.
Yeah, Monday night. So we're doing our thing. And then on Sunday, we're in the middle of a meeting, and I start getting texts from my wife like, well, it might be happening. Like, don't worry yet. Don't change anything yet. I think I'm okay. We'll see. I'm like, okay. So I'm like watching it. And across like 3 hours, maybe, she starts going into like full on labor. And so I had, so, you know, obviously our movie's not showing until the next night. She's kind of in labor, and, you know, I'm just thinking in my head, I can't miss the birth of the baby. You know, like, it's going to suck to miss the movie, but I got to go. So I change my ticket, and then I get to the airport, and I'm waiting in line at the security gate. And while I'm in line, she has our son. So she's sending me pictures of the baby from the hospital room. My parents are with her and everything. So I miss that. And like, oh man, okay, well, that's fine. And then by the time I get to the front of the security line, you know, we're in Utah, in Salt Lake City, and my connecting flight was Denver. And Denver got hit by a huge winter storm, and the airport shut down. So the flight was canceled. So now what do I do? I don't know. I'm not going to sit at the airport forever. So I popped in an Uber, went back to Park City, and met up with Matt again, and we went to our agency's party that night with the cast and crew, and everybody was like, what are you doing back? And, you know, told them the story. I'm showing them the pictures of my son, you know, and like, can't get out of here until the morning. So we partied all night, went back to our house. I think I spent like 2 hours there, and then went back to the airport at 3:30 in the morning or something like that for a 5 o'clock flight that they had put together because of all the canceled flights through Denver. Got back to Wisconsin, and then I was holding my son in the hospital room when Summer of 84 premiered at Sundance. So that was my experience of it.
Poor guy didn't get to be there. It was just, yeah. I mean, it was honestly electric to be there, and I wish Steve could have been there, because there's no audience like a film festival audience. Like, people who are just like, because our movie sold out quick, you know, and so people were hyped to watch it. And, you know, at the end, it was just like, it was just chaotic. It was so much fun. And just to hear the last, you know, because Steve and I had never seen the movie with an audience until that point. You know, we'd seen cuts of it. It was amazing because they're laughing where you want them to laugh. They're like oohing and aahing where you want them. They're screaming where you wanted them to. It was really just a lot of fun. And then afterwards, we got to do a Q&A. And I told the audience, like, I got a question. I told the audience about Steve's predicament, that he couldn't be there because he just had a baby. And the whole audience went crazy for Steve.
Awesome.
It was a lot of fun. And, you know, hopefully our next film will be at a film festival, and maybe Sundance, and Steve can see, he can see what it's like, you know, next time. Yeah. But we missed him.
That's pretty wild, though. You know, you got to be a dad and have your film in the Sundance Film Festival on the same day.
Yeah, not bad.
Before I flew out, you know, the cast of kids, you know, we were all kind of having dinner, and, you know, they're all around the table like, you got to name the kid Sundance. You got to name him Sundance. And, you know, I was just like, we're not going to do that.
Rough. Yeah. No, that's a good call not to do. The kids that you cast, you know, y'all recast, you really focused on their age. And, you know, what was your relationship like with them? Do you keep in contact with any of them now that they're older? I know their careers have gone on, and some of them are doing, you know, some substantial things still. So,
yeah, we're in touch with all of them. They were all, I mean, we got lucky because not only were they all super talented, but they're also just like amazing kids. Like, we're in touch with all of them. We're in touch with some of their parents still. Like, Graham Brashear's parents like text us, you know, just to say hey, to send us articles about Summer of 84 or whatever. So yeah, it's been really cool. And honestly, all those kids, like, when you're shooting a movie that's independent and you have 21 days to shoot it, you know, you don't have a lot of time. So when you're shooting with younger kids, you can get a little bit nervous, because if they're not buttoned up and super, you know, if they're not really doing a good job, you could be in a lot of trouble. You could quickly fall way behind. These kids just nailed it. I mean, we didn't have any issues at all. They were such pros. We got very lucky.
Yeah, it was also interesting
because you have tight constraints too with kids too. Sorry, go ahead. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say, like, it was also interesting with Caleb specifically, because, you know, Caleb's a little older, and you know, we made a joke about it in the movie that he looks 30, and, you know, because he was in his 20s at the time, and so, like, you know, we'd be filming these scenes with him during the day, and it's like, okay, he's 15 years old, and then, like, we'd be like, cut, all right, let's go out for drinks, you know, and Caleb would be there drinking with us, you know. It was kind of bizarre, you know, stepping back and forth into the teenage years.
Yeah,
well, the lady that played the girl next door, she was like 23 or 24 as well, though, wasn't she?
Yep. Yeah.
I forget her name.
Her name's Tierra Scobie. Yeah, she was 23 when we filmed. Yeah.
Well, I know you were awarded Best Screenplay at the Cinepocalypse Festival in Chicago. Was this anticipated?
Steve got to be there, and I couldn't be. So, Steve, tell us about that.
Yeah, so that was an interesting one, too. So obviously, I was living in the Milwaukee area at the time. And I just saw that Cinepocalypse was showing Summer of 84, and it was just totally randomly. And I was like, oh, like, that's only like a 2 hour drive. So I texted the guy who was running the festival, and I just said, like, oh, like, I don't know if you're aware, but I'm local, you know, and like, I'd love to come down and watch it. And he was like, oh, okay, cool, do it. And it was like same day. So I just hopped in the car and went down, and then got my festival badge. And as he was handing me the badge, he's just like, oh yeah, he's like, I want to introduce you to some of our guests. And it turned out to be Scott Derrickson and C. Robert Cargill, who, if you don't know, they're the guys who wrote and direct Doctor Strange and Sinister. And yeah, they got the Black Phone coming out now. Okay. Trailer like just dropped today. And so they introduced me to those guys, and they were like super fans of the movie already. And so they were, you know, talking about how they'd already seen it at a different festival, and now they were here as judges on the panel for you know, voting everything. And they were like, oh, do you want to introduce the movie with see Robert Cargill. And I was like, sure. So we waited, and then he brought me up on stage and, you know, super like, you know, celebratory. And, just, you know, so we introduced the movie together and then watched it. And then after the filming, we all just went out on the back patio and hung out for like 5 hours, just having
so
drinks
cool.
and telling stories about Hollywood. And, you know, and I was kind of like basking in their, you know, spotlight as like people came up and knew who they were. And, you know, we're talking all about all that. And then I left. And then, you know, a couple days later, we got the notification. Oh, hey, like, you know, they voted you in as best screenplay of the festival. And it was like, oh my God, like, I didn't even know that was a thing, you know? So it was total shock. And with the bonus of getting to meet those guys who are heroes of ours and, you know, getting to hang out with them, and they're just super cool.
Well, in previous interviews, RKSS said they felt a sequel to Summer of 84 would take away from the original. How do you both feel about this?
Well, it's also interesting too, because in independent cinema, the possibility of a sequel is very, very slim unless it's a huge breakout hit. And because we didn't have much of a theatrical release, I think we were in just over 100 theaters over the course of a few weeks, there's really no basis to do a sequel. In other words, sequels are always based on box office, you know, prosperity. Like, how well did you do? Because we didn't really have a theatrical release, there's just no financial basis to do a sequel. So on that alone, there will never be a sequel. Like, barring some absolutely bizarre turn of events, there just isn't going to be a sequel. But I would also say that, you know, Steve and I just never intended for there to be a sequel. We've definitely, like, played with the idea of, like, maybe we could do a graphic novel sequel. Because, you know, it does leave on a cliffhanger where you're like, what is going to happen to Davey? What is going to happen with Mackie? And I think that that's very fertile ground to tell another story in. But it's just not going to happen as a film. There's just, you know, the financial reality would just, you know, not going to allow that to happen. What do you think,
yeah,
Steve?
Yeah, for sure. Everything you said. But I think, like, story-wise, you know, I think they're kind of saying that, like, you know, it would take away from, like, that shocker ending, because now you're seeing what happens afterwards. And I would say, like, I can kind of see that, but I can also think, like, if you do it right, it just adds to it. And, you know, if you feel like it doesn't, it's like, you know, you can just kind of ignore it. Like, a lot of people don't like Ghostbusters 2. They just pretend it doesn't exist. And Ghostbusters is still a great movie on its own, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's true. You know, you brought up Ninja Turtles 1 in an interview you did a few years ago, and I'm like, so do you feel the same way about Ninja Turtles 2, Steve?
I mean, I love Secret of the Ooze, but, you know, it's definitely a different thing, you know?
Secret of the Ooze.
No.
Wait, no, isn't Ghostbusters 2 Secret of the Ooze?
with it did well. It really did well streaming, though, didn't it? Like, this thing popped rocks on Shudder. If I'm correct in that, right?
Yeah, for sure it did. And Shudder's been great, by the way. At the time, it's funny, when Gunpowder and Sky told us it was going to be on Shudder, we were like, what's Shudder? Because at the time, Shudder was like brand new. Like, you know, we're horror fans and we hadn't even heard of it. So we were one of their first, I think we were maybe their second exclusive release.
Yeah.
Right after Mandy, right, Steve, was it?
Yeah. And they were really close together. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, it's been great being on Shudder. It's really cool that there's so many horror fans that are just, like, you know, dedicated to this one place to see horror. So it's been really cool. It did do well on Shudder, but again, it's sort of just like, you know, it doesn't mean that there's a financial reality to there being a sequel. So it's a tricky thing. But it's been great to have our SVOD life on Shudder.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you've moved on. You've been busy, and you're not in the horror game, like, all the times, because right now you've got a movie in post-production called The Knocking. I know there is a movie Knocking, which has probably become a pain in your ass as well, I'm assuming. But the movie called The Knocking, and it's again, you collaborate together for this, and it's your directorial debut together. Could you tell us a bit about that? Are you able to tell us some about it?
Yeah, we can talk a little bit about it.
Right, cool.
It's basically, right. Like, so The Knocking is kind of more of a slow burn thriller, and then sort of towards the end, like, ramps up into, like, full horror. Yeah, like, the story of the movie is that there's a guy who moves to a new town. His ex in his old town was cheating on him, so he left to try and start fresh, and he's having a hard time meeting people, but then he meets this girl that's kind of like the perfect girl, and they hit it off right away, and they start dating, and everything's great. But he starts to realize that she's never invited him over to her place. He doesn't know where she lives. And he starts to suspect, like, maybe she's married. Maybe there's something she's hiding from me. And so he's trying to figure things out. And then one night they're at a bar. They both get a little bit of drunk. she drops her license and he sees her address and uses the opportunity to get an Uber, and they go there. And then he goes in and everything looks normal. And then they fall asleep. And then at 3 a.m., there's just this crazy aggressive knocking on her front door, like somebody's trying to break down the door. And she wakes up and he wakes up, and then he says, somebody's at your door. And she's, you know, you can't get it. Don't get it. I got to protect you. Don't get it. And then the movie spirals off from there. Like, who is that knocking at the door? And then it ends up going into a supernatural horror kind of place by the end. So,
yeah, we just love the idea of, like, you know, I think we live in a day and age where when someone knocks at your door and it's like dark out, it's weird. Like, if someone knocks on your door during the day, it's like, oh, it's FedEx, it's UPS, it's whatever. But at night, if someone knocks, it's like, that's weird. Like, why would someone knock on the door at night? And we just, I mean, you know, if you talk to the average person, you ask, like, what would you think if someone knocked on your door at, like, you know, midnight? It's, like, instantly freaky. It's like, what is going, like, what could be happening? So I think for us, it's sort of just, like, tapping into that, like, how evocative that fear is. That, like, and if someone was knocking over and over again, like, what's, you know, what's going on and what do you do?
Mm-hmm. So then a lot of the movie is kind of, has, in essence, I'm looking for a word to describe it. Like, there's kind of an emotion or a mood to it that kind of draws into the story as well. So it has to come off the paper to really deliver, is what you're telling me.
Yeah, it's definitely like a moody mystery where you're like, what is? You're constantly you're seeing the movie through the eyes of the main character, Sai, and you're kind of just like, what is going on? Like, what is this girl hiding? What's actually going on here? And that's kind of where you feed off the energy you're feeding off as an audience member. And then hopefully you're very surprised by where it goes and the reveal at the end.
How was your experience working with Doug Jones and Zelda Williams?
It was amazing. Man. They're both amazing. I mean, like, you know, I mean, Zelda, obviously, like, the daughter of Robin Williams, and, you know, like, she's just, like, brings that same kind of energy, but it's, you know, her own, you know, and, like, she was super nice, super professional. She's also a writer director, so she was kind of like, you know, helping us a little bit, you know, behind the scenes, just kind of like giving us pointers and, you know, that, and like just super, super sweet. And then Doug Jones, like, I don't even know how to describe him. Like, he's like the sweetest guy ever, you know, like he's on set, you know, like wrapping people in hugs. At one point he like walked up behind me and kissed the top of my head because like I'm only 5'8". He's like 600, yeah, you know, yeah, like yeah. Whatever, you know, like super tall, lanky guy, you know, like just an amazing, amazing guy, you know, like right off the bat, you know, he's calling himself Dougie to us and, you know, like that. I mean, amazing to work with him.
Yeah. It's funny. We're doing an ADR session with Doug next week and we both can't wait just to hang out with him again.
You know, he's been busy. I know Zelda's done a couple of films before as well, but he's had, what was the film he was in recently? That was,
well, Doug's in the Star Trek series that's on CBS, so he's just been busy. I think he's just recently got a break, so we're catching him in a nice little window where I think he's got some time. But yeah, that guy just nonstop works and has his whole career. He has such an amazing career.
Yeah, there was also a funny moment on set where we were kind of setting up this forest scene, and we had him out there in costume, but, you know, didn't quite need him yet because we were kind of setting things up. And my daughter was on set that day, and she kind of knew the scene. She knew the lines. And so my daughter, like, I look over at one point and, you know, Doug, this super tall guy, is sitting on like a tree trunk with my 9-year-old daughter, and they're running lines together, you know. It was like nice. So surreal, you know. And afterwards he was just like, she knows the scene better than I do. It's crazy. You know? It's really funny.
How long was the shoot? Where were you at?
Oh man, what was it, 19 days, Steve?
I think, yeah, it was 19 days.
That's quick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was all over LA, basically.
Yeah. And we actually shot it like at what at the time was like peak COVID in LA. So it was like the summer. So this was like August of 2020. So at the time, COVID numbers had never been higher in LA. So we were like on the cusp of getting shut down before we even got to start shooting. And like the day before, the week before shooting, we found out we were going to be okay to shoot, but it was just like touch and go. So, you know, COVID protocols were really tight, and it was like a heat wave in LA. It was like 100 degrees every day. We got masks on, goggles. It was this whole thing. It was a really trying production in a lot of ways because a lot of our budget ended up having to go to those COVID protocols. So, you know, whereas.
Yeah, what were those more specifically? That's what I'm curious.
What, the COVID protocols?
Well, yeah, I mean, it, like, you know, because you got the Hollywood sets already kind of confusing to people. You got COVID-19 protocols thrown in the middle of it. It gets.
Yeah, I mean, some of the things is like when you, like, every night we had a COVID protocol person, like a person on set who was like the person who checks your temperature. You check in with them every morning. They would also send you a questionnaire every night that you had to answer before you arrived at set. That's like, do you feel okay? Do you have a temperature? Do you whatever? Like all the questions that to kind of get at the heart of if you have COVID. And then just like, you know, again, yeah, you got to check in early because they got to take your temperature, make sure everything's okay. There was one day where it was like 105 degrees and I showed up on set and they were like, it looks like you have a fever. And I'm like, no, it's just 105 degrees out right now. And like, I got put aside and I'm like, we're like trying to start prepping for the day. And I had to like wait because my temperature, and then eventually my temperature came down when I had a fan on me but it was just like, you know, it was one of those things. But there's just a ton of little things like that, like everything from how your lunch is boxed has to be COVID protocol, you know, approved, like everything has to be sealed, and all of those expenses, you know, fall on production. So, you know, it's just the cost kind of mounted.
What are you looking at as far as the release date? Do you know?
No, we're still in post-production on the film because VFX shots were just kind of like VFX shots are coming in. We're starting to give notes approve certain ones.
So, all right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the goal is to hopefully come out in a film festival next year. And then, you know, if all goes well at the festivals, somebody comes in on board and you know, acquires the film and puts together a marketing and distribution plan. So it'll come out next year. We just don't know when. You know, it could be Halloween of next year for all we know.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes time.
How is your working relationship directing different from writing?
I think the main difference probably is just that, like, you know, when you're writing, it's just the two of us talking to each other. And it's just, you know, we've got our system down that's, you know, over a decade old at this point. And we've got, you know, we're very free and loose with giving each other notes. There's no ego, like Matt was saying earlier. Whereas when you're directing, you know, you're standing in front of a crew of 100 people, you know, kind of like telling them what to do. And so it's like, while Matt and I, you know, have our moments of being able to like kind of confer and make sure we're on the same page or whatever, it's just different. It's turning that energy out instead of just keeping it insular to the two of us.
All right, that makes sense. Do you feel like you took a lot away do you want to do it again as far as the directing process? I mean, obviously you're well resonated into writing, but do you want to direct again? Do you like getting farther into the involvement with the actual overall production? I know you do, Matt, but I mean, you're obviously producing and stuff. I guess you do as well. So.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. We're actually kind of in the early phases of putting together a new one. Hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll be directing it early next year. Another one that we wrote. So we're super excited about that, kind of getting into a little of the casting process and pulling all the pieces together. So yeah, but we're really interested in it. And our experience on Summer of 84 really kind of nudged us into the directing because, you know, we loved watching RKSS and they did a great job with Summer of 84, but it was like, while we were on the set, we were just kind of like watching how they did things and going, well, that's interesting. Like, you know, like we could totally do that. You know, like maybe that could be something we can aspire to try out. And then when we had the knocking done, we kind of went out and we just said like, we want to direct this one. And luckily we found people who would let us do that.
Yeah. It's there's something about, you know, when you write something and you hand it off to somebody else to direct it, it's a tricky process because, you know, everybody's got different opinions, and something that you think is important, somebody else won't think is important, or something that you don't think is important, they will think is important. And you're always just kind of like playing this game of give and take with when you're the writer and you're dealing with the director. And in the feature world, eventually what happens is as the writer, you just kind of just get pushed to the side. And you're no longer, you know, asked for your opinion on things once it's in production in general. So it's kind of a tricky place to be because, you know, you could write a script that's well received and then someone comes and makes it and it's a terrible movie and people think you're a bad writer. I mean, that happens. There have been people in the past who have written a movie, it came out, it was terrible, and then they couldn't get work anymore because the movie was so bad and people are like, well, you wrote the script. So it's a tricky thing. I mean, luckily RKSS did a really good job with Summer of 84, but we also were just like, if we can do this ourselves, we should, because then we can really like maintain, you know, the like what we're trying to say, like the themes that we're trying to talk about, or the, you know, the characters that we're trying to depict, and we can really make sure the integrity remains.
You know, I know we're getting a little bit short on time, but I do want to ask, this may be off cusp, but it kind of went around the table during some of the discussion before the interview. Steve, I know that you have a background in, like, originally you started off, like, drawing comics and stuff like that, right? Am I in the ballpark here?
I did,
here?
Yeah.
Now, with
Yeah, for sure.
Has that factored into, like, storyboarding at all? Does that roll over into film at all now?
Yes, but more recently than ever before, just because now we're starting to direct. So, you know, just as the writer, you don't really ever have a need to storyboard necessarily. I mean, I've definitely drawn out some scenes and blocked them just to figure it out during the writing process. But now, like, now that we're directing, yeah, like, I'm kind of throwing together some, you know, rough storyboards. I mean, I haven't been, like, an official artist in a while, you know, so skills are a little down, but good enough for storyboards. And it definitely helps to kind of visualize the scene and everything. The reason I got into writing in the first place was I was going into animation at first, and this was in college, and then I took an elective writing class, and my professor then was just like, because you're an artist, your writing is super evocative and visual. He's like, I kind of think you should come over here. And at the time I was drawing, you know, 4,000 still lifes of stuff and just getting really super bored in that kind of a program, whereas with writing you can just create worlds and characters. And so I came over, and that's how I got into it. And So definitely being an artist has influenced just, you know, the visual storytelling nature of everything, and now storyboarding as a director.
That makes sense. So where are you at in your own worlds today? I mean, I know you have a lot going on together. Are there any projects that you work on independently of each other? I know, Matt, I know you've done some stuff on the side. Steve, I know you've done some stuff on the side. But what about currently?
Well, Steve, you should talk about your novel.
Oh, yeah.
You wrote a great novel.
I did. I wrote a novel. It's called The Saw Real Confession. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the places.
That's the poster behind him.
Nice. Yeah.
To the other one opposite, yeah, yeah. For, mm-hmm. I'm assuming. Okay,
yeah,
cool,
so that
cool.
One's like kind of like a big blockbuster kind of action spectacle sort of thing. So for fiction, for sure, like I do a little bit of short story writing on the side and that kind of thing. But in terms of screenwriting, you know, we're both kind of in lockstep with each other and just really do everything as partners at this point. You know, like Matt said, like I got into screenwriting a little bit before he did, so I have a little bit of a body of work from before Matt and I got together. But you know, the screenwriting definitely, like, you know, went up to next level once Matt, you know, came on board and we started writing together. So at this point, I mean, we do everything together.
Yeah, I know Steve does have aspirations to keep writing novels on the side. Like, you know, when we have more time, it's like, it's funny because I think we've done a good job of creating a slate of projects that keeps us really busy. You know, I have a couple projects that I'm producing sort of separate from what Steve's involvement is, just because, again, I think I have a little bit more bandwidth. Steve's got two kids, you know, and so it's like I have a little bit more bandwidth to kind of like try to do a couple other little things on the side. But in general, like Steve said, we're pretty much just work exclusively together and try to just continue to push that forward.
All right. Well, as I said, we are running short on time. I'm Poxy Leonard here with Miss Reagan, and we've been speaking with Stephen J. Smith and Matt Leslie about their screenplay and production for the 2018 RKSS film Summer of 84. It's been a pleasure speaking with you both, and we very much appreciate your time.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Good fun. Happy Halloween.
You're listening to The Ghost of Hollywood. I'm Miss Reagan, and we'll be back shortly to say goodbye. Also, please don't forget to check out Summer of 84 if you haven't watched the movie yet. It's available on various streaming platforms and definitely a Halloween cult classic on the rise.
All right, thanks, guys. You have a good evening.
Thank you.
Can't get enough of The Ghost of Hollywood? Check out our entire first season, now streaming wherever you choose to listen to your podcast. And don't forget to like and subscribe.
While you're at it, check out our website at theghostofhollywood.com so that we can keep you up to date on all the latest with The Ghost of Hollywood.
Welcome back to The Ghost of Hollywood. I'm Poxy Leonard here with Miss Reagan, and the time has come for me to grab my trick-or-treat bag and get the hell out of here. I'm ready to go. Let's go. Let's go.
We'd like to thank Matt Leslie and Stephen Smith for joining us on the show tonight as we begin our second season and prepare for another lovely Halloween. Please know that if you haven't seen Summer of 84 yet, that it's streaming on Shudder and serves as the perfect Halloween date night flick or a dream terrorizer for you and your teenage buddies.
And I know that we touched on it briefly in the interview, but Steve is also an author and has recently released a new novel entitled The Sabriel Confession. The book is a story focused around the angel Sabriel and his six brothers, who were sent to protect the newborn Christ.
But along the way, they discover the damned have been using a lost gateway to heaven, which they must destroy. And this leads to a huge battle which gets pretty crazy. But I'll leave the rest on the cliff for you listeners out there to check out. The Sabriel Confession can be found online, We'll put up a link on the website, too.
Speaking of the website, we finally built our own, which can now be found at theghostofhollywood.com. There, you can check out all of the episodes from our first season and some other good stuff pertaining to our lovely little late night ensemble. Also, please don't forget to donate to KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon by visiting their website at kboo.fm.
Again, a big thanks to our crew here at The Ghost of Hollywood and our production staff at the Electric Garden Company. It's great to be back on the air, and without our crew keeping it all together, none of this would be possible.
All right, wall crawlers. That'll wrap up things here tonight for our Halloween special. Make sure to be safe out there and to share all of your razor blades with friends.
Poxy.
What? Okay, fine. Sorry, whatever. Happy Halloween and all that good shit, yeah.
We'll be back next month with more cult trash and cinema right here on The Ghost of Hollywood. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Instagram to keep up with all the latest news on the show. And that covers it. Until next time, everybody.
Good morning and good night.
What the hell, Poxy? That's my line.
You always get to say goodbye. It's just not fair.
Look, I don't mess with your stupid wall crawler shit, so stay off my lines,
oh, whoa,
old man.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Serving it up, are we?
The Ghost of Hollywood is recorded at the Electric Garden Studio and broadcast live at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Direction provided by Zach Flannery. Writing and program development by Chris Klon, Reagan Flannery, and Zach Flannery. Samples developed by Jesse Garcia. Performances by Reagan Flannery and Zach Flannery. Coordination and communication by Mary Flannery.
For more information on The Ghost of Hollywood, please visit theghostofhollywood.com. Copyright held by The Ghost of Hollywood and Electric Garden Studios in Portland, Oregon.